Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Become a paid member and get ad-free episodes, early access episodes, and bonus episodes in their entirety. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who's a paid member that helps to make this podcast possible.
He refuses your offer, says it is betrayal of our Lord. You see, once loyalty begins, it does not have an end. Otherwise, it would not be loyalty.
Again, basically what I said to Patrick Klepek when we started doing this podcast together. You know, once loyalty begins, it does not have an end. Patrick Klepek, you're locked into Decoding TV forever, whether you like it or not.
I keep rejecting the invites, and I keep finding myself at this computer with a tea set in front of me, and I'm so sad.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today?
I'm here, David. I'm here.
Patrick Klepek and I actually had a chance to hang out this week. I traveled to Chicago and then Indianapolis to be in the path of totality for the solar eclipse.
Known as my two children. That's how I introduced. I was like, David, welcome to the path of totality. There are a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Patrick's nickname for his children. But it was lovely to see Patrick and his family. And also, incredible experience to watch a total solar eclipse. I would strongly recommend. You know, Patrick Klepek, it was amazing experience. I'll be posting my vlog on my YouTube and on my Instagram and TikTok and so on. But it was so transformative. I'm like, am I gonna have to make my whole personality this now? You know what I mean? Like, am I gonna chase solar eclipses now? Is that my whole thing now?
I saw. Did you see the it was like Delta, or there was a flight that was built around being able to watch. Apparently it was profoundly disappointing. Like, you could barely, like, it sounds really neat to be able to try to watch the eclipse on a flight, but getting the angle correct means you sort of just see it in like very brief passing.
Well, not only that, but like literally half the plane can't see it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
well, they try to account for that by like, and now it's the other plane's turn, and they're like turning the plane in order. Like, the blog I saw about it was like, it sounds very cool, and it was neat. You're probably better off on the ground.
It was an amazing thing where it's this. We're you and I, Patrick Klepek, we're used to going to events. Mm-hmm. Where you need to line up or pay $500 a ticket or whatever to go see this thing. But it was really neat to be able to just go to a location and literally wherever you are in that general area, you can see the thing you went there for. You know, like, that's a nice thing. So anyway, it was really amazing, and I would recommend it if you are able to be in the path of totality. The next one won't be in the United States until 2044, but you will be able to see other eclipses in other countries over the course of the next couple decades. So I am now weighing whether or not that's a thing I want to do, Patrick Klepek, but it was really impressive and amazing, and I would recommend it. One other quick note, by the way. There is a massive difference between seeing a solar eclipse that's total versus one that's only partial, even if it's 99% partial. So it's a whole different thing. If you can travel to be in the path of totality, aka Patrick Klepek's name for his children, then you should strongly
traveling
recommend.
Traveling to Chicago to see me was only 94% enjoyment for David. I could not fulfill 100%. He had to drive another 3 hours to Indianapolis, which people in the Midwest are always saying. Chicago seems nice, but where you want to go is Indianapolis. And David took that advice.
I will say what is funny is, you know, I post on my Instagram stories that I'm in Indianapolis. And I got a lot of DMs from people who live in Indianapolis who said, hey, sorry you had to come here to see the solar eclipse. No joke. I'm 100%. I'm not exaggerating or making that up. Multiple separate people DM'd me. They're like, "Hey, I'm really sorry you had to come here." But
David, I live in the orbit of Indianapolis. Not that. I mean, it's 3 hours, but like I've been there. Like I get it.
All right. Well, anyway, welcome to Decoding TV. Today on the podcast, got a bunch of TV news for you, and then we are going to be discussing Shogun Episode 8, Abyss of Life. We're going to be reviewing and recapping that episode. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. Hey, David Chen, what about the Prime Video original series Fallout? I mean, not only is Fallout out by the time you're listening to this, but this podcast is, I'm going to argue, this is one of the best podcasts on the planet to listen to if you want to hear an intelligent discussion of Fallout, because we have Patrick Klepek, who has been covering video games for literal decades.
Yeah.
We have me, David Chen, who's been covering television for about a decade and also used to work at Prime Video. You could not ask for two better subject matter experts on the subject. Why no Fallout episode today? Well, just as the gods conspired to have the moon block the sun for 4 minutes, similarly, the gods conspired it so that we could not deliver this Fallout episode for you today in a way that felt timely, because Patrick Klepek, you and I, we ask for screeners very regularly. And sometimes we get approved, and very often we get denied.
Funnily, in this case, did not get the screeners through Decoding TV. Got it through my other job, the video game job, and yet we could not deliver it to the Decoding TV audience.
I got screeners separately through my relationship with Prime Video as well. And so we're like, oh man, awesome. We got the episodes in advance. We can prepare. And then I didn't get the episodes till really late. The eclipse happened, so I was away from home. And then Prime Video decides to drop all the episodes early. Usually they drop the TV shows and movies on Friday. This one was supposed to come out on Thursday. They moved it up a day even further, so that by the time our episode came out, our episode recapping Fallout will come out next week, it's going to feel quite lame. No, I'm just joking. It's still going to be a great conversation. But I just wanted people to know, basically, we really wanted to have an episode talking about Fallout today. We couldn't get it, sort of all the pieces to fall into place for it to make sense. We will be covering the first three episodes of Fallout on Prime Video here on Decoding TV next week. So look forward to that, in addition to the next episode of Shogun. And finally, I do want to also mention there's a bonus episode on the way for the rest of Three Body Problems Season 1. So you can look forward to that. I think we'll be posting a preview on the main feed and also the full episode for paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. So that's what you have to look forward to. A lot of stuff coming your way here on Decoding TV. I'm looking forward to it here with Patrick Klepek. All that said, even though we're not going to be talking about Fallout today, Patrick Klepek, we can talk about a bunch of the news that is surrounding Fallout. There is a story here at Kotaku that's saying Fallout TV series already gearing up for a second season. And sort of reading the tea leaves and seeing that a second season seems pretty likely. Patrick Klepek, what'd you make of this?
Not shocked that you can kind of, you know, there's been a buzz about this show leading up to its release. The fact that dropping all the episodes at once, the fact that they're moving up the date that they're dropping, that seemed like a direct response to social media, early reviews of the show. It's like, screw it. Everyone, it seems to be liking the show. Just put it out early and try and capitalize on top of that. So, we'll speak to the show itself next week. But what I have seen of it, I'm not shocked personally that they are deciding to move forward with a season two of the show.
Yeah, because you need to, so much investment goes into world building, pre-production, creating the look of the show, casting the show. For a show of this size, scale, and ambition, of this budget, often it just makes sense to make another season. I think this is true of Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power as well. They're kind of really ready to green light season two of that right out the gate.
And deliver it in a timely fashion, right? These shows of this scale, even if everyone is just mostly pivoting from season one is done, let's work on season two. We have seen time and time again, it doesn't matter the expense or talent involved. Like, it's not the kind of thing that turns around a year later, right? You're looking at usually 2 years between seasons, even on these really big shows. And so if you have a confidence that it's going to be good, get those, you know, wheels turning as soon as possible so you can minimize any scheduling, you know, sort of stuff, like just to get the show on the right track. It sounds like they have a confidence, and by just getting tax credits lined up, actor schedules lined up, makes a lot of sense to make sure that happens sooner rather than later.
To paraphrase the Robert Zemeckis film Contact, the first rule in video streamer spending, why make one season when you can make two seasons at twice the price? And that's kind of what is going on here, I think. As you indicate, the tax credits is what gave this away. According to Variety, the California Film Commission revealed last week that the productions that will be receiving $152 million in tax credits to film in the state, and Fallout Season 2 is on the list, set to receive $25 million. Now, either Fallout Season 2 is going to happen, or they're going to lose out on $25 million. And Patrick Klepek, I don't know about you, but feels like $25 million is not something you want to turn down, you know, just in general.
No, and I don't know the exact process for applying for things like that, but I don't think it's the kind of thing where you just wake up one day and be like, I'd like to go get some tax credits, please. You know what I mean? I feel like that's the kind of thing, like, as a show is going the editing phase of the first season, you know, Amazon starts to see, like, okay, do we have a, you know, what kind of hit do we potentially have in this? We're not sure. That's something that's a little bit unknowable, but you can kind of know what's a good show. And like, I think signs like that are good early indicators that they feel like they have something here and that they're just ready to move forward on at least that second season. And as a, you know, I don't know how soon credits like this were applied from an Amazon relative to a Netflix, but you know, we're sitting here still waiting, you know, with this episode on, is Three Body Problem getting a second season, while Fallout, a show that as of this recording isn't even live yet, already has bits and pieces suggesting very strongly that they're going to move forward with at least a second season.
I believe it is live, actually, as of this recording, if I'm not mistaken. But it, because I think it got moved up to today. But in any case, yeah, that said, anything's possible, Patrick Klepek. You know, we've seen shows cancel that have already been in production. We've seen shows cancel that have already been completed. So who knows what will go on, but it does seem very positive. Jonathan Nolan has been giving a bunch of interviews, and one thing he said was extremely shocking to me. So this is from a story in The Hollywood Reporter. Jonathan Nolan is ready to unleash Fallout and finish Westworld. What? So what is he saying here? So in this interview with Jonathan Nolan, The Hollywood Reporter, the question is asked of Jonathan Nolan, who is one of the creators behind Fallout. Is there any possibility that Westworld's original planned ending will be dramatized in any form, whether as a graphic novel or a movie or anything? Do you still have hope for that? ? Jonathan Nolan's response, yes, 100%. We are completionists. It took me 8 years and a change of director to get Interstellar made. We'd like to finish the story we started. The question is then asked, how much did Warner's taking the show off of Max bother you to not just cancel it but remove him from the service? Jonathan Nolan responds, look, my career began on CBS with Person of Interest. The amount of people you can reach with free ad-supported service like Roku and Tubi, which had Westworld last year, is vastly higher than with a subscription service. That part didn't bother me. But in terms of finishing the story, you understand that you get the time that you get. Sometimes it's as much as you want. Sometimes it's not. I'm so fucking proud of what we made. It was an extraordinary experience. I think it would be a mistake to look back and only feel regret over how it ended, but there's still very much a desire to finish it, end quote. Really shocking that he's still thinking about this. And also, by the way, it retroactively makes more sense, his comments or Evan Rachel Wood's comments about them not giving away the ending to her, because she in a previous Decoding TV episode, we discussed how Evan Rachel Wood really wants to know what the ending of Westworld would have been, and the creators refused to tell her. And we said, hashtag justice for Evan Rachel Wood. And it turns out they have a good reason for that. It's because they are still dreaming of actually maybe finishing it somehow. Patrick Klepek, what was your reaction when you heard this?
One, that was a very diplomatic response to like the kind of question of like, oh, those meanies took it off, you know, HBO. Right, and you got this new show, which he's not show running. He's directing some episodes. He's creatively involved. But it seemed kind of teed up to be like, do you want to say something mean about like David Zaslav over at HBO? And he chose to not take
right.
debate and actually had a pretty thoughtful response to like, hey, it's actually cool that more people might see the show. Like HBO does pitch itself as a not niche, but like prestige, limited, like cool club that you're entering to watch like a certain style of show. So I thought that was really interesting on his part. I also thought it was fascinating that he used the word completionist, because I've read a handful of interviews of his over the course of this Fallout press tour, and it's like abundantly clear he's a longtime video game fan. Like that's a huge part of his involvement here. It's not just this is a good script and some creatives I've like he cares about Fallout as a property, as a world, and he cares about video games as a medium. I mean, lots of Westworld is very much influenced by like open world game design. So I'm not none of this is shocking to anyone that has watched his work over the past decade, but it makes like completionist is a term that is used by video game fans because they are obsessed with finishing things like trophies, 100%ing a game. And I couldn't help but when hearing that word, wondering if there's a bit of his approach to video games that he then is taking to this approach to finishing the narrative of Westworld, which is if you got to the final chapter, most people don't finish video games, but lots of people that love video games, once you start it, you want to see where that story ends. And the idea of getting to chapter 11 of 12 and just not finishing it doesn't make a lot of sense. It would be like infuriating to not see how it ends up. And he seems to, taking that completionist attitude to the story that he's crafted, I think it's kind of a fascinating insight to Jonathan Nolan as a creative. And I don't think that word is, I think it's used with precision. It's kind of revealing about his thoughts on storytelling and the like.
Now, Patrick Klepek, are you a completionist when it comes to video games?
No, never have been. Certainly not with kids, which heavily restricts my free time. But no, I like to sit down, like feel like a sense of progress in a game. I do like to finish stories. Like I am a completionist in the sense that when I start a story, I like to see it through. But you know, games where you open up a map and there are 9,000 icons. Like, what's the glowing icon that gets me to the next main part of the story? That's the one
that
I'm following.
Because in video games, you can complete the story and not complete all of the quote-unquote trophies or goals
Correct.
Of the game. There's all these often very side quests. There's often just one-off tasks to do. My brother is a completionist. He will 100 is I think one of the terms you can use is called 100%ing a game, right? You getting 100% of the trophies or the achievements of a game. I am not. I think it's just because some of those are really, really tough, right? Some of those tasks can be really obscure, or it's like talk to this one guy that you met one time 3 hours ago in the game, and then you have to backtrack all this way to find this guy
or just time. Like it's less difficult and or obscure as much as it's a time investment. Like it's going to take just hundreds of hours. I have a buddy of mine who is very much a completionist, only plays really open world games, but plays them in the most bizarre way possible, at least from the way I play video games. But like when he gets a new Assassin's Creed, which is his favorite series, opens up the map, looks at all the icons, ignores the story, does all of the icons, everything you can do in the game, and then begins the story. At which point he is now, level 90, a god, and just like waltzing through the main story content. But to him, checking off all little icons is the appeal of being in the world. And then the story is just a thing to do to sort of say that you've actually finished it.
I went from being angry at Jonathan Nolan for not telling Evan Rachel Wood the ending of Westworld to now being sympathetic to Jonathan Nolan.
It's principle,
because
right?
Because like, it's probably eating away at him that he has not been able to finish the story. And I am really curious, like what format the show, the completion of it will take. He doesn't hint at what that might be. but it could be anything. It could be a movie, could be a comic book, could be a 5-minute YouTube video of him explaining what the ending would be. You know, like it could be anything.
And it'll be like in one of those Wired like videos where like they're like reading off like autocomplete questions, like, right. Like Google searches, like how did Westworld end? Like 4 years from now. And he's like, yeah, I guess we'll just do it here. So here's what we intended for season.
It'll be in the GQ.
Don't tell Evan Rachel Wood, though.
Yeah, it'll be in the GQ video of, like, Jonathan Nolan evaluating his career. And by the way, here's how Westworld would have ended.
I do think he's giving it time, right? Like, who knows what conversations he's had, hasn't had with HBO. Obviously, Westworld was a huge part of... like it was the blockbuster that HBO had, especially as Game of Thrones was winding down. Those two shows were like in parallel. It's not just like where you go to HBO for like best in class television. Like, no, you come for like best in class television, but also like huge blockbuster spectacle storytelling. And so however Westworld ended, my guess is they still value him as a creative. And I wonder if he's just sort of holding out a candle for an opportunity that hasn't quite been snuffed out. And until that happens,
right,
why spill the beans on how the story is going to end if there is a chance that, who knows, maybe part of this experiment is like it goes off to Tubi. Hey, turns out, like, give some people a break from the show, get a little nostalgic about Westworld, and maybe there's an I don't think any of these things are going to happen. I think this is more just the door was shut on it and he's processing, right, the door being shut. But maybe there is a world where, you know, you give it a couple of years and people forget that they didn't like the last couple seasons of Westworld. And you know what I mean? But I mean, right, that's right. Why I stopped watching.
But,
I
was like, but here's the thing.
But if they told me like one more thing of Westworld, I was like, I'd probably come back for that.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, as you indicate, you know, Fallout is on Prime Video. And so he's obviously not spending all this time working with Warner's on a Max show at this point, although he very well may in the future. But also, this interview may be a signal flare itself. It may be like some exec at HBO reads this and it's like, oh, I guess, maybe we should dig the old Westworld out of the closet and see what's up there. It's also very possibly contingent on how well Fallout does. Like maybe Fallout, right, gives him a lot of juice and maybe he's like, hey, I want to make the end of Westworld. We know that no one will watch it. We know it will be unprofitable, but maybe they do it just to, like, you know,
as a solid, like, hey, I'm going to do another show. As a package, right, right, you know, you can imagine scenario. Like that's how we talked about it previously, that HBO has often done their creative solids to let them finish a story. Even if it is obvious, it is just a solid to the creative and the story itself, which is what made the cancellation so shocking, because it's just not usually, you know, I was more expecting, oh, it's gone from a season order to a 4-episode limited series, but it lets them finish the story. And instead, it's just like just completely done. So I think you're right that maybe there's a chance that Fallout blows up and it's like, oh, man, we'd love to have Nolan's name on something again. And Westworld gets a shot.
Well, we'll see what happens there. But yeah, interesting. This is not something I expected at all. And hopefully he will get the chance to conclude the story of Westworld.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right. Let's talk about another story. I saw this on the Hollywood Reporter, you know, and there's been a lot of publications covering this. But there was an article headline, I'm Scared, Why It's a Brutal Time to Be a TV Writer. Subheading, the end of peak TV has ushered in an era of contraction with fewer buyers and fierce competition for the few shows that are staffing. People are in total survival mode. This is a piece by Leslie Goldberg and essentially talks about all the difficulties TV writers are having getting a job right now. And there's a few highlights from this piece that I wanted to read. A decade ago, broadcasters once collectively ordered as many as 98 pilots. Today, that number can be counted on one hand. The overall volume of U.S.-produced live-action scripted TV series tumbled 14% last year, from a high of 600 in 2022 to 516 in 2023. So we actually did reach peak TV at last, it seems, in 2022. And I doubt it's ever going to get that high again. Like, I think that was it. That is the peak. There are some quotes here, very scary. Brandon K. Hines, who's a TV writer, says, you need multiple gigs a year to make a livable wage. It's the craziest time to be a working writer in Hollywood. You can work on a semi-hit show, but you still can't afford to make a living wage. It's pretty intense. End quote. Patrick Klepek, I'm struck by how this the stuff that's happening in the video game world is mirrored by the stuff that's happening in the TV and film world right now, which is to say, a lot of consolidation, right? A lot of creatives struggling to make a living, and essentially a massive come down from the pandemic, right? Like, COVID made it so that people were streaming more TV shows than ever, and people were subscribing to Netflix more than ever, and people were playing video games more than ever. And then when people basically returned mostly to normal after that, a lot of companies didn't know how to handle it. Tons of layoffs across many organizations, across many industries. And it's a really difficult time right now. Patrick Klepek, do you have any reaction when you're reading the story?
I mean, I think one thing that's, you know, pointed out by the story is I don't think it's clear to enough people how much writing in television in Hollywood in general is like a freelance contractual business in which you are not interviewing for a job to then get a salary at a place you're going to be at for several years until there's some sort of churn or a project's over. Like, so often what's being talked about here is like you get into a writer's room. Part of the lament over the the smaller episode counts for lots of prestige television shows is those writers' rooms, they don't last as long. So you're trying to participate in multiple gigs at once. I mean,
I think you're underplaying get into the writers' room. It's like there's like 500 people applying for one job now, right? So getting to that is
correct.
Difficult. And then, as you indicate, once you get to that, it doesn't last as long.
Great. You have a job for 6 months that doesn't pay well,
exactly.
But may dominate all of your time, effort, passion. And how are you supposed to then, while you're doing that gig, line up either a gig that is parallel or at least picks up when that one drops off? And I think it's especially difficult in this period where the industry just hasn't settled, right? And so much of this is unfair. A lot of it is complete greed and miscalculations on the part of companies who are bending over to shareholders in order to find, better stock prices and the like. But all that said, one of the big problems is that we just haven't come out on the other side. What is the new normal for video games? What is the new normal for television, for film? You can disagree with the tactics taken by the corporations involved, as I do every single day, of how they're arriving at this new normal. But if you are just a cog in the machine, the way you figure out how do I fit in here, or if I don't, how do I come to the conclusion that I do not, is to understand what even is the landscape. And so it's a lot, you know, there's a line in here that's been echoed in video games as well, is like, fake it till you make it until like 2025, right? Like, if you can just survive a little longer so that the numbers become real, like commitments are able to happen. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to, like, a lot of people are going to leave video games. A lot of people are going to leave television and movies. But for the people that remain, the people that are going to try and make it work, what is available to them? And right now, that's the huge problem. It's like, what is available to you? And the anxiety I got over reading all this story is also why there are so many times in my career I have stayed at jobs I do not like. I am underpaid. But you know what? The paycheck shows up every 2 weeks. And that is not the best reason to have a job. But if you live in an expensive city, if you just got bills to pay, having money that you can count on, that you know is the same or roughly the same amount every 2 weeks, allows you to plan your life around it and make the necessary sacrifices to make that work. And so what I so deeply, like, this is why I've avoided being, it's why I avoided being the job that I'm in now, just like running multiple small businesses where the money fluctuates week to week, month to month, because I like the way I like spend money, the way I conceptualize like my life and my budget is I always liked just having the same amount of money come in and then I work from there. So I have a deep amount of sympathy for the people in this story that cannot have any measure of stability. Because what you'll notice here is not even necessarily a bunch of people being like, I'd love to be paid a lot of money. What they're saying is, I would wish to be paid some amount of money on a consistent basis that I can plan a life around. Because those are different things.
Right.
Like, you can be poor and find a way to make that work if you know what's coming in. But if you don't even know what's coming in, you can't even plan around being poor. And that's how you end up with people who are in writers' rooms, like in this story, that are also homeless, because you can't figure out a life around even a meager amount of income. And that's really distressing.
I think I'm just struck in general by how many steps go into this process, right? And like a lot of the chaos described in this piece is also around people, executives not being able to make decisions, or like no one knows who's in charge. No one knows who's greenlighting what. And that happens because there is chaos on the organizational level. Like there's layoffs, there's reorgs. And so a new person is put in charge of the film division and a new person is put in charge of reality. And like, and then it's like, okay, so am I, is that person who I'm taking notes from now? Or is that person determining the budgets now? Or, you know, whatever. Yep. And then, so there's all this chaos there at the organization level that then trickles down to when you're actually making the show, like no one knows who's in charge. And then it's hard to get staffed. And then it's hard to actually do the job. It's hard to like get scripts through because you don't know who. And then at the end of all that, like then we here sitting comfortably on our couches with our Netflix, we then kind of consume and then judge the actual final product. But it's like there's just so many steps along this intestine of, you know, what happens to make the stuff that we see. And we are seeing like somewhere in the midpoint that is kind of what this article covers.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of struggle right now. And as you indicate, a lot of people think that there will be a rebound because that's what's happened every single time in the past, right? There's always been a rebound. Like there's a contraction and then people are like, oh, actually we need to make TV shows again. You know, like that's what's happened every single time. I don't know, man. I don't know. Like, I'm just like a pessimistic person in general. I think there will be a little bit of a rebound, but I think, you know, it's never going to go back to 2022 era again. Well, I think
it's more, games and TV are mostly, it's a contraction.
Yeah.
And then that's the new normal.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. As you said. Yeah.
But that's the thing. We don't, how far is,
what is the new
contraction?
Normal?
What is like, what becomes the new baseline? And then that determines like so many, like that determines what kind of shows are ordered, the scale of them, the staffs, and like, it's just none of that's settled. And so even if the contraction is permanent because there's no longer, television, studios, television, companies, places like Netflix who are treated more like technology companies than they are studios, like, and they're transitioning out of this early phase of like, you know, charge nothing for the services, accumulate users. Right. Now we're doing password crackdowns. There's price increases every week. We're making less content, which is all like not unexpected, but we're in that rocky phase where it's like, well, then what, who exists? Who are the players? What do they want? And we just don't have, like, Paramount is in the midst of like probably being sold. Like, all, so many things are shifting. Like, like Warner Brothers might get sold again. Like maybe all the stuff that's been going. I mean, you know what I mean? Like it feels like there is still several steps to be taken where we just don't know who's ordering what. And until you know that, you know, you're going to be a writer or someone in that, like that part of the ladder in Hollywood that is just kind of holding on for dear life.
Absolutely. One final comment about this is just, I am curious how this is going to impact Decoding TV, because I will tell you right now, our experience, at least my experience, Patrick, and you probably agree with this, is there's just a lot of new shows to cover right now. There's a lot. And I wonder, like, we are, again, being at the tail end of this process, is like a lot of these shows were greenlit during a different era when things were really nice and flush and frothy. And we are now in a tough era. And I wonder, like, when we are going to start experiencing the impact of this on Decoding TV. Probably 6 to 12 months from now, there's going to be like times when we're like, what the heck are we going to cover? Because I will tell you, in June right now, we got we got The Acolyte, we got the boys, we got The Bear. And on Cast of Kings, we're going to be covering House of the Dragon. And so it's like, wow, there's so much stuff. And then, you know, I'm curious, like, when we're going to experience the effects of this, because it's probably going to be in 6 to 12 months. So
yeah,
stay tuned. We are experiencing the history of the entertainment industry right here on Decoding TV. All right. One other story I wanted to mention, and then I wanted to talk about the Curb Your Enthusiasm season finale. But here's a story to mention first. According to The Independent, Netflix users divided over Ripley due to stylistic filming choice. This is a piece that is run at theindependent.co.uk. Casey Newton, one of my favorite tech journalists, he once described this genre of news article called the search results news article, where it's basically a journalist types in something into a search engine and then gets some bad results and then writes an entire article about that. Not necessarily the most like incisive, you know, hard-hitting, valuable to society.
Yeah, who are these people? David, who are they? So, it's not even mentioned in this article. Are they Reddit comments? Are they YouTube comments? Like, no, Netflix users. How the fuck do you know if they're a Netflix? Show your work, Independent.
So that's what this article is. So I have no illusions that this is like a journalistically valuable article or anything like that. But these articles, they're fun. They're fun to talk about, Patrick Lepik.
Water cooler article. Oh, the young people hate black and white television shows.
Yeah, Netflix users are switching off from the new series Ripley over a stylistic choice in its filming. Some fans have been left frustrated by its defining feature. It is entirely black and white. I'm going to just read some quotes. I didn't last the first episode. The cinematography is so annoying. Why on earth is Ripley filmed in black and white? Surely the only reason to not film in color previously was technology. Totally killed it for me. The dog seems quite okay with it, though. Black and white is a good way to keep the budget down, but adds nothing. End quote. I just think our education system is broken. You know, like... people thinking that you can film in black and white to save money, you know? The other logic being that, if you can film in color, why wouldn't you? There's no conceivable artistic reason to film in black and white. Truly, the children are not our future. That's kind of what I have to say about this.
Well, this is why with my kids, even when they watch Disney Plus, they're not watching Disney Plus. I rip those shows down. I convert them in Adobe Premiere to black and white, and then I feed them back to them so that, you know, like some people take their kids and like, I want you to experience the movies I watched and kind of in the order I watch them, like we can enjoy them together.
Right,
I need them to experience technology as well. So my kids are 7 and 4. They haven't earned color yet. We're talking maybe in middle school, they'll have an opportunity to, David, you didn't understand
this is probably why your kids were losing their mind when I met you recently. Cause it was so wild that there was a human in full color in front of them. Right.
And they were like
that was weird reaction.
We can use mom and dad's phone. There's colors on here. That's not what it's like at home.
Wow. Learning a lot about Patrick's parenting style. But, here's the thing I really appreciate is the article also quotes someone from Twitter, the company now known as X, saying, "People moaning they can't sit through this gorgeous black and white cinematography. We need to bring back pretentiousness, gatekeeping, and standards quickly." End quote.
See, that's a shitpost I can get behind.
I saw one of these kind of posts recently this post reminded me of that was like, somebody, you know, when you watch the Super Bowl, as we discussed, or the Oscars or whatever, it's a nonstop cavalcade of celebrities promoting shit, promoting like Uber Eats or Mountain Dew or whatever. And somebody said, I remember this quote was something along the lines of, they posted this video of like the Mountain Dew commercial and said, "I truly think one of the worst things to happen to millennials was losing the concept of selling out," right? Like that essentially, like, most people, there is no longer a stigma to selling out in our generation, like there was in previous generations, like Gen X or whatever, right? Maybe we need a little bit more of that gatekeeping. Maybe we need a little bit more of that shaming, Patrick Klepek. What do you think?
Good luck. Let me know how it goes. The kids seem ruthless these days, and I would simply avoid them. I'm going to go to the digital side of the other side of the street, and I'm just you don't have to enjoy your black and white show. I'll enjoy my black and white show.
Yeah, are you just generally, are you a fan of black and white stuff? I love it. You know, I'm a huge fan of black and white. Love taking photos in black and white. I love when movies are shot in black, it's a fundamentally different experience.
I like when they're shot in black and white. I hate the trend of, I just didn't even see it out of principle. It was like the black and chrome edition of like Mad Max Fury Road, which I heard was like a pretty good version of one of these, but like a movie that is shot in color. And then like, you know, what's cool if we take the color out, and it's just like, that's not how it was shot. I don't have
First of all, I actually got to strongly disagree with you, Patrick Klepek. I mean, that is the black. In fact, that was the version I was thinking of when I said that statement.
People defend this as like, no, this is a good one of those. And I just hate it on principle and refuse to engage with it.
Wow. So you're one of the people in this article, basically. You are part of the problem.
It was that movie shot in black and white, and did they add the color in post?
All right.
George Miller's out here in his edit bay with a Apple pencil, like, well, I think the red should go here. No! Maybe he shot it with in mind for black and white, and it works. Okay.
I think you're choosing the wrong example, Patrick. Let me just put that out. I think you're choosing the wrong example.
No, I'm saying I disagree watching film.
This is a version that George Miller, director of Mad Max Fury Road, has said. He has said, hey, that's the better version of the movie.
Oh, and have you seen the new versions of The Abyss and Terminator? Like, great, I've got AI all over my like great films from the 80s because James Cameron loves technology. Just because the creator says it's the best version of it doesn't mean I have to accept it.
All right, you're right.
David.
It's true. Maybe he's trying to sell his new black and chrome version. That's very possible.
I don't know. I'm not calling George Miller a seller. He said,
quote, "Something about black and white, the way it distills it, makes it a little bit more abstract. Something about losing some of the information of color make it somehow more iconic," end quote. I have seen the black and chrome version in theaters. Like, I went to bought the actual Blu-ray. And I'll just tell you, the effect on me of watching a black and white is it removes information, right? Mm-hmm. And what that does is it allows you to focus more on what is there. So the shot composition, right? The shadows, the lighting, the stuff that is there, you focus more on. Now, I can accept that you don't prefer that for a movie like Mad Max Fury Road, which is bursting with information everywhere, but I think it is a very legitimate creative choice. And I think you don't disagree with that, right? Like, you think...
No, I think there's
shooting something in black and white, totally legitimate creative choice. It just rubs you the wrong way when people try to double dip with
it just feels it feels like a pretentious version of a 3D version of a movie. I think the black and chrome is the exception that's like that proves the rule.
Right, like, that's what I'm saying. It's like you chose the wrong example, Klepek.
That's why I pointed it out, because I knew that you were going. I knew David Chen was immediately going to be like every other film Twitter person and be like, yeah, but the black and chrome version is good. And I agree with you. I just sort of use that as an example. Like, I know people point to that one, but anyway, the original point. I love black and white stuff when it's shot that way, and I've had Ripley on my queue as something to like. It's the like when I have some free time, I want to check it out because I've heard nothing but great things about it. And the fact that, look, for all anxiety over Netflix and how it does its business, it's cool that like the biggest streamer in the world is like funding like a black and white interpretation of this story. So who cares if the kids are wrong? I'm glad that, you know, you've got Netflix, you know, like Roma and this, like movies that like really center black and white cinematography and like with the benefits it brings. It's cool that it seems to be like mostly Netflix is like where I've seen stuff like that happening more often than not. Maybe it's because they put out more than everyone, but I like the fact that they don't. I like the fact that they don't, you know, it's easy to imagine, like, I don't think the algorithm prefers black and white.
Right.
And so at least there is some measure of, hey, this is what the artist wants to do, and they think this is the best way to get that across. I think it's cool that a show like that can still get across the finish line at a place like Netflix.
Agreed. Well, Ripley is a show that we, you know, I would like to figure out a way to cover on this podcast somehow. We're still trying to figure that out. And that's another thing is, you know, we cover some shows week to week. We also cover some shows by the season. And so Patrick and I are trying to figure out how to be even more expansive than that. Like, maybe there's shows that only one of us watches and we still want to figure out a way to cover it somehow. So we are in that process, and obviously always open your feedback at decodingtv@gmail.com. But on that note, there is a show that I watched this week that I want to talk about that Patrick has not seen, but it must be discussed. And that is the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So there's going to be some minor, arguably major spoilers for Curb Your Enthusiasm starting right now. So like, if you don't want to know how the season ends, then you should skip forward until our recap of Shogun, and you can see the timestamps in the show notes. But I want to say I watched the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. I didn't watch every single episode this season, but I watched a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And I had heard there's a lot of talk about this series finale because Curb Your Enthusiasm is a show that's been running for over 20 years, Patrick Klepek. Over 20 years.
I remember watching this show. Decent gaps in between some of the seasons, right? Like, it's not there's not 20 seasons of the show.
Correct. I think it's only like 12 seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So I remember watching the show in college, you know, like with my roommates. We watched the show. And the show came to a conclusion this year and this last week, and I heard a bunch of buzz about the finale, so I checked it out. Now, the Curb Your Enthusiasm series finale was essentially a remake of the Seinfeld series finale. And Seinfeld, a show, Patrick Klepek, tell me about your relationship with Seinfeld.
Oh, I mean, that's a formative, like, sit down with the whole family when a new episode is on. Like the finale of that show was like such, it's hard to convey what Seinfeld and its finale was as a cultural moment. Like, we're talking Avengers Endgame, like the whole world is like, this is not something that happens on television anymore. Maybe Game of Thrones is like the closest it's like kind of felt, but that was still a show watched by a fraction of the amount of people that were watching mainstream television shows like Seinfeld. And so, yeah, it was a enormous deal to sit down for this show, like a comedy show. Who cares what the final episode of a comedy show is? And, well, the entire world wanted to find out what was Seinfeld's last joke going to be.
Yeah, it was a huge freaking deal. As you said, formative thing. You know, it was when we had a monoculture back then. Everyone knew about Seinfeld. Everyone was watching Seinfeld. 76 million people watch the Seinfeld series finale.
Unfathomable. Like, so many people.
I think people estimate that 100 million people went to see Avengers Endgame during its worldwide opening. So, like, not quite Avengers Endgame level, but, like, you know, it's up there. It's in the high double digits, right, yeah, of how many people watched it. And I remember being, you know, Seinfeld, big deal for me. Like, I've watched many of the episodes multiple times, and I love the show. And I remember being crushingly disappointed by the series finale, or watching it and being like, that was it? That was my reaction. Patrick Klepek, did you experience something similar? Like, the Seinfeld series finale is about the four main characters being on trial for not assisting somebody in need. And then the prosecution brings a parade of witnesses from these characters' past testifying to how terrible people they are. That's the Seinfeld series finale.
Right. It ends with a shot of the four of them bickering in a jail cell, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Yes. It's fun. I was young enough that I don't remember my own personal thoughts on the finale as much as I remember the cultural response to the finale, which was, you know, we compare, you know, Seinfeld finale to Avengers Endgame. I'm sure people can quibble on how they felt about Endgame, but like, it was more or less like a beloved cultural moment, like a nice capstone to this, to the MCU, and its cultural run. Seinfeld's, like, the finale was, well, that sucked. Like, that was mostly like the response to that finale, and has lingered as a thing that Jerry Seinfeld, Larry David often talk about and comment. You've gotten the sense that they're a little bitter at the culture's response to how they wanted to end their show, which was, you know, essentially to remind people, you may have been laughing at these people for the last 10 years, but do you remember that they're kind of just a bunch of unlikable assholes? And that's
right.
Kind of what the show was trying to get across in its finality, was sort of not quite turning a lens on the audience, but certainly reminding them that these are some unforgivable like assholes. That's kind of what the finale was walking you through.
Right. It's like, don't forget who these people really are. And
we're
going to summer it all up in this one episode, right? So yeah, it's definitely become like this really legendary, mythical thing, this finale of this wildly popular show that a lot of people were very disappointed by. And I think, you know, in my opinion, the cardinal sin was it wasn't very funny. Like, I think people didn't think it was very amusing. And so it felt kind of like a lecture. It felt very didactic, you know, the series finale of Seinfeld. So Curb season 12 just came to an end. And in the first episode of the season, Larry David gives a bottle of water to a woman standing in line waiting to vote in Georgia. And this is against the Georgia law about, you know, against election fraud. Like, you can't help people out who are, you know, waiting to vote. And the entire season is engineered around this finale where Larry David goes on trial and a bunch of people testify about how Larry David's a shitty person. And it is basically a redo of the Seinfeld series finale. It ends a little bit differently. There's a few details that are different. One nice touch is that there's the person who he gave water to, one of the nice people, like, the show figures out a way for her to turn against him, which is, like, very funny. But it's basically the same thing. And Patrick Klepek, I didn't find the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm particularly funny, but I admire the will it takes to hang on to basically a grudge against the American public for over two decades.
I love it.
And to be like, I was right. I, Larry David, was right. You were wrong. This is funny and or a good way to end a TV series. And I'm going to do it again over 20 years later.
And look at his track record. More often than not, he is right about what things are funny. And I'm with you. There was a clip going around from Jerry Seinfeld at some point, either early this year or last year, that had people speculating that maybe the Seinfeld was going to get together for like a Super Bowl ad, and the way that they'll do like reunions for bits like that. Even after Curb Your Enthusiasm essentially did, it's the one season I wanted to go back and watch because I love Seinfeld so much. They did essentially another season of Seinfeld embedded within Curb Your Enthusiasm during its run. And the speculation was, oh, maybe there'll be some sort of Seinfeld reunion that's happening. And as it turns out, that was just indicating that Jerry Seinfeld already knew that Larry David was going to double down on this premise for a finale. And so the fact that it maybe works a little bit better is I love the fact that he decided to just take a whack at it again. I think there is something no more Larry David, given the sense of humor that was embedded. Seinfeld as a show works. Yes, it's a collaboration, like, hugely between Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David. But there's more Larry David than Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld is the face of it, but I think a lot of the humor, like, especially watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, you just see so how much of it really was Larry David, and how much is missing from Seinfeld in some of its later seasons when Larry David was less creatively involved in as that show was ending its run. So I fucking adore the fact, like, who cares if it's good? I love the fact that he just doubled down, because this is probably like one of the last great things, like the last big things that he does. Like, I'm sure he will still do creative works. Get the itch to do another Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think not, actually, because of, now that cast members are actually passing away, I think that
he's 76 years old at this point.
He looks old, right? Like, I was watching some behind the scenes clips of the finale, and it's like, you can see him. He is 76 and you can see it. And I think that's a beautiful way to go out. Like, that is, like, he's earned the right to put up two middle fingers and say, I was right.
As a summation to the show, it's fine, right? Allison Janney appears in the finale and has a stare down with Larry David. That's fun. Richard Lewis has a nice plot line in the episode. Jerry Seinfeld shows up in the episode and riffs with Larry David for a little bit, and that's nice. So as a summation to the series, it's fine. It's not great. It's not terrible. It's not particularly funny, in my opinion. But as a meta story, like, if I didn't know the meta story, I'd be like, okay, that was okay. Like, it was perfectly adequate. A perfectly cromulent ending for a very good show. But as a meta story of Larry David's, like, you were wrong, I've been saying it for 2 decades, and I'm going to say it again in the most definitive way possible, you got to admire it. You know, I'm not even mad. I'm impressed, right? Like, the audacity, the tenaciousness, right? Like, can you imagine believing something? Like, my opinions change over time, Patrick Klepek. I don't know about you. Like, sometimes I'll think something was really good, and then over time, I'll be like, maybe it wasn't that good, or something was bad, and I'll revisit my opinion. This is the thing where he's like, the Seinfeld finale was always good. It was never bad. I knew it was always good. I've always known, and now you will know again. That's kind of, it's amazing. So,
and it makes sense as a sort of a period on the sort of arc of Larry David as a comedian, so central in our lives, where Seinfeld, he is a behind the scenes creative, right? Like, he is, that's why, like, it's so interesting to watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I watch, a handful of seasons. It's like, you just see, like, oh, I understand Seinfeld so much more watching this show.
You understand the engine that was driving it, right?
Even though Curb Your Enthusiasm is like prompts that lead to improv, whereas like Seinfeld is like written scripts that I'm sure had a much lesser amount of improvisation because it was filmed in front of a studio audience. It was a different era of shooting comedy, but the fact that he's front and center in Curb, he is the main character, and like, so for him to bring that all full circle to this moment as he kind of exits out as being probably a predominant force like in comedy, I think that's just beautiful to me.
Agreed. All right. Well, that is a bunch of the stuff that happened in the world of television this week. Let's get to the section of the show where we review, recap, and discuss specific TV episodes. I want to again mention we'll be having a bonus episode about Three Body Problem, season 1, that's going to be coming out in the next few days. And next week it's going to be Fallout episodes 1-3 and also Shogun episode 9. So that is the homework for next week, but let's get to it. Shogun episode 8. Engumi niyori warera ga yori tsuyoku musubitsuku という案いかがでございましょうか? Mariko-san, don't go to Osaka.
My allegiance forbids me from doing anything else. 我らは敗北に向かう道を進まれる殿に従うことはできませぬ。
そなたは己の務めを果たす覚悟ができておるか。
All right, welcome to Decoding TV's coverage of Shogun Episode 8, Abyss of Life. And I want to mention, if you're finding us from YouTube at youtube.com/@DecodingTV, you can listen to the podcast version of this. Wherever you find your podcast, just search for Decoding TV. I want to read an email from Lucas writing in to decodingtv@gmail.com, commenting on our episode last week discussing A Stick of Time. Lucas writes in, I was deeply moved by the titular scene of this episode where Jin, the courtesan, beseeches Toranaga for future security for her people in Edo. I felt this was not just because it was an empathetic view of sex workers, but because of how powerful she was. I watched this scene with my partner, whose take on the scene was more or less a mirror of yours. Jin wanted something tangential to the problems of the moment and wrongly assumed Toranaga had a plan. In talking it out together, we came to an extra layer that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. The extra layer here was the intention on Jin's part. She didn't think Toranaga had a plan. She knew he didn't. She saw the peril they were all in. The show on multiple occasions has gone out of its way to let us know that the stakes, if Toranaga dies, are not just his life, but everyone in his service, including Jin. The show has spent a significant amount of time teaching us about Willow World, about the particular brand of service Jin's tea house provides. They are ostensibly sex workers, and that can be part of it, but they do so much more than that. They talk about servicing not just a man's desires, but his needs. So Jin does not despair in the face of the peril in the episode. Instead, she goes to work. Toranaga is not a man who will be moved by desire or lust, but Jin, as a master of her art, knows this. She refocuses his attention on the future, his plans for Edo, while at once ensuring a prosperous future for herself and her girls. But that's not enough, because as he points out, they're done for. So Jin reminds Toranaga of who he is. She says, hang on, you forgot about tricks? Dude, you love tricks. And she does it in exactly the way he needs to receive it. In effect, she creates the geisha class and saves everyone in the clan all within her tiny stick of time. I am not a book reader, so I guess it's possible that everything goes awfully, but I strongly suspect that Jin next-leveled Toranaga in that scene using her master courtesan powers, and I loved it. What do you all think? End quote. This is a great interpretation, Patrick Klepek. I mean, I think, you know, we could have spent a little more time talking about that scene with Jin and Toranaga last week, and you know, I've thought a lot about this, and I ultimately just think that the way that Toranaga is played is just too inscrutable for me to really come up with a conclusion for what was actually going on in that scene, right? Like, did Toranaga have the plan the whole time and Jin was, you know, reacting to the possibility that he didn't? Did Jin actually spur him to make the plan? You know, that's probably the most narratively satisfying one. That which is what Lucas is proposing. But I guess I am curious, Patrick Klepek, if you had any reaction to this email and when Toranaga came up with a plan to triumph over his enemy.
I love the interpretation. I'm swayed by it in terms of what happened. But that's clearly not, maybe not clear, that's not how I felt watching.
That's not, yeah, that wasn't your interpretation.
That's not how I felt when we talked about it. And part of what I'm loving about this arc of the show that they, you know, really doubled down on, it is the central focus of the episode we're about to talk about, is like, who is Toranaga? What is the myth? Who is this person? What are they up to? What are they not up to? And it's this deconstruction of our impression of a character without any sort of interiority to that character at all. And it just leaves, scenes like this so ripe for interpretation that I think even by the end of the show, I suspect we will not have clear answers on where, when, why. Even as the plan, so to speak, is becoming a little clearer to us as the viewer. I think what's going to be part of what I'm suspecting will be part of the beauty of the show is you'll be able to go back to scenes like this and go, oh, this could have been exactly as this interpretation rolled out. But I don't think, I suspect that we will not, this is not going to be the kind of show that you're going to go back and be like, oh, I can directly line up
It's all locking into place, right? I think it's very open to interpretation, but I think Lucas's interpretation is very valid. And it's one that had occurred to me, but I just, again, and by the way, an instinct that I think was vindicated this episode. my instinct was like, hey, just don't really put too much stock into what Torunaga appears to be at any given
time. Yeah.
Because he could be putting on a show. He could be deceiving, you know, and that's how I felt last week. Is like, does he have a plan? Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. Who knows? You know, I'm not going to try to spend too much time thinking about it because I don't think the show gives you that much to go off of. But I think Lucas's interpretation, super valid. So, yeah. Okay. Shogun episode 8, Abyss of Life. Patrick Klepek, what'd you think of the episode?
Oh, man. The amount of times in this episode where I just quietly said to myself, oh, fuck. It's just, there is, I mean, there are so many, there are scenes in this episode that we could spend a whole episode's length dissecting, talking about. There are just tour de forces between actors and culminations of emotional moments. This is your quintessential. We had a lot of kind of quiet before the storm. Like, this is the like a lot of those pieces kind of coming together before a powder keg, I think, is about to explode in this show. And there's just really wonderful payoffs for so many character dynamics where things, we have scenes where things that have been left unsaid between characters that we've only had a minor exposure to, but we know that these dynamics go back decades that mm-hmm. we get payoff on. We have dynamics between characters where so much is going unsaid between them, and yet so much is being said in the subtext of what's like. It's just, man, it's exquisite storytelling. It is a very patient show, rewarding the audience for their patience, and it makes me just so tremendously excited to see where this is all going to end up, because it has rewarded me every step of the way. And it's really nice to be in a place with a show where I just know I'm going to be shocked, surprised, delighted, and laugh all in the same measure. And the show just seems to have it all. And I think this is it's not a show you could just hand to somebody out of context and be like, this is why Shogun is great. But if you've been watching the season alongside us, it feels like just a perfect encapsulation about everything that is great about this show right before a lot of people are about to die.
Completely agree with you. And I think the main theme of this episode is, what is the value of loyalty, right? Is there anything inherently valuable to being loyal to a thing or a person or a purpose? This is a thing that some people on the show, at least, are asking themselves as the episode goes on. And it seems to be something that the show comes back to again and again. So, I thought it's a very thematically rich episode. And also, Patrick Klepek, it fulfills the Shogun formula that I keep saying week after week. Tons of people sitting around in rooms talking, punctuated with one or more shocking acts of violence. That is that is what this episode continues to deliver on, and I can just check it off each week as I've gotten my fill of Shogun.
Your Shogun, you have a bingo card at this point.
Yep. yeah. Let's talk about what actually happens in this episode. In the cold open, everyone is heading towards Ido, carrying the body of Torunaga's son, who died last week after getting a little bump on the noggin, if you recall.
Bonk.
Torunaga is given 49 days to mourn before his son, before being delivered to Osaka. Which, by the way, I just, it is wild that all this, like, propriety, right, is getting in the way of Torunaga dying. It's like, hey, we got to have an election for the regents. You know, we got to have select the fifth regent because we can't make any decisions without having five regents. And we can't.
All they want to do is kill this guy. Everyone agrees. This guy's got to die. We got to kill him.
He's got to go.
The way that loyalty, bureaucracy, honor, the blurriness between those things, like what is loyalty and what is just bureaucracy, I think is one of the more fascinating like elements of this show. If I was drinking something, I would have coughed up water when it was clarified to me in the show that he was about to get 49 days of calm before everything moved forward. Like, 49 days? You gotta be kidding me.
Also, like, his son was acting in violation of whatever orders, you know, like,
right.
His son was trying to murder. Now, he did not succeed, But it's just, even given that, they're still like, well, we got to do the honorable thing and give him 49. So,
right.
Anyway,
it's right.
That's how seriously they take this stuff. There are three main stories in this episode: Torunaga, Blackthorn, and all the stuff that's going down with Ishido and Lady Ochiba. So let's just talk about the two shorter plot lines first. Ishido and Lady Ochiba. Ishido praises Lady Ochiba's genius strategery by allying with Lord Seki. But Lady Ochiba is not convinced that they have succeeded. She won't be until she sees Torunaga literally underfoot in front of her. Ishido is clearly smitten by Ochiba. There's this, you know, Patrick Klepek, there's this trend on TikTok, or this kind of trope on TikTok of like, POV, you know, your guy friend is about to ruin your friendship. Mm-hmm. Which is like a common thing where, you know, a guy that your friend, if you're a woman, a guy you're friends with, like, gives you this look and you know he's about to say that he's like romantically attracted to you and therefore ruin your friendship. Definitely got a lot of ruining friendship vibes from Ishido this episode.
That, and I enjoy that Ochiba looks at Torunaga as Jason Voorhees, which is, look, we can lop off his
until
arms.
Until I see the cold body dead in front of me.
Yes, he until his head has been lopped off, we've buried it in the ground and then burned his body to ash. I do not believe. And, you know, she's not wrong. And I like the way that you can, you get such a sense of how much she truly fears Torunaga and like the trauma that has been like imprinted on her, that leads this character that, you know, we described just recently as like, like this final boss character, but this final boss character is also like deeply afraid of this other character over off to the side. And it makes her a much more, interesting character all told.
So Ishido does ask for Ochiba's hand in marriage because he thinks this would make for a really good alliance.
But think about it.
And you can tell she's really overjoyed at the prospect.
Yeah, she's thinking about it.
In a later scene, we see Lady Dayoin gravely ill. That is the Taiko's wife, right? Who is gravely ill. And there's a very moving scene when she dies. She tells Lady Ochiba, hey, release the hostages, end this madness. And then she also says, Ishido comes from nothing and is nothing, which is like, wow, brutal. Because she basically doesn't want him to, doesn't want her to marry him because he's not worthy of it. And she's like, just end this madness. Stop taking the hostages. You're going down a bad path, Lady Ochiba. And then she dies. And it's actually very powerful because she kind of talks about, you know, her dying words are very powerful and seeing the afterlife and so on and so forth. So I thought it was very moving. But then Ochiba seemingly disobeys her dying wishes by then deciding she's got to marry Ishido. Obviously, I think this is a main theme of the show of people being on this path of vengeance and like not being able to deviate from it, right? And that becoming a huge problem. But any other thoughts about the Ishido and Ochiba storyline this episode, Patrick Klepek?
No, mostly, you know, it's not like I'm rooting for Ichido, but also I'm just sad for my boy. Like you're taking a lot, you're taking a lot of swings that I think you're gonna whiff on here, buddy. Like the show is like clearly setting him up as, I mean, over the course of the show's run, at no point do you see him as, wow, a master calculated, you know, he's essentially on the opposite end of Torunaga. And here
he's so like infatuated with Ochiba. Like it's actually kind of pathetic. And it's a great performance. It's like,
but he's never been
he,
so forward about it. Right. Like it's, he's sort of attracted to her from afar, but he starts taking some real risks here. Like saying like, oh, you know, our Lord, I mean, we revere him, but he was a real piece of shit. Like we all know this. Right. And that's how he then pivots to an offer for marriage. He's just taking, he's putting himself out there and we got to respect that, but he is a pathetic, sad boy and none of this is going to work out for him. And I'm pretty sure that he is going to die in the coming episodes.
All right. Patrick and I have not read the book, so we're just guessing here.
Yes.
Want to be clear. All right. Blackthorn pays his respects to Torunaga in this episode. Mariko gives Blackthorn the book of all his terrible deeds and says he'll be released, but who knows what the upcoming regents will do to him after they take control of the kingdom. Blackthorn tells Mariko not to go to Osaka, but her allegiance prevents her from doing anything else. Blackthorn also sees the priest, who I think is named Alvito, in the city. The priest is impressed by Blackthorn's assimilation, and Blackthorn explains his intentions to reunite with his crew and take back command of his ship. So later on, Blackthorn reunites with one of his men who is none too happy to see him. Turns out only six of the men are left, and the men he encounters blames Blackthorn for them being in this predicament where they're slowly wasting away with no prospects. The conversation takes a turn when he insults Blackthorn's outfit, causing Blackthorn to beat his ass. Patrick Klepek, curious about what your thoughts were on this. This is a pretty critical scene. In my opinion, it's the whole show for the last like 7.5 episodes. Blackthorn has been trying to get back to his men, and he sees this as critical for his. He's like, he has this whole story in his head. I'm going to go back to the men. We're going to get in the ship. We're going to go back and have more adventures and do other stuff. And then confronted with one of his men who calls him out on his bullshit, Blackthorn does not take it well. What'd you think, Patrick Klepek?
I saw this in a forum discussion on Shogun somewhere, comparing the arc of Blackthorn to like the white kid that goes do a semester abroad in Japan and then goes, I'm Japanese now. There's a term in gaming.
Or it's more
anime, but a weeb how you might describe Blackthorn. It's the culmination of this character where whatever his identity was or lack thereof, and like how much of Blackthorn that we've met in those opening episodes was a performance, a person searching for meaning, identity, purpose, has found it here. And that confrontation with, the folks on his ship, which you characterize it as multiple people. He only sees one of them. He only talks to one of them. The rest are off screen. He doesn't.
Correct.
I think it's important that he does not even make a meaningful attempt to see all of them.
Right.
He sees one of them, has a poor encounter. And what was much funnier was he attempts to skedaddle away. Like he gets led there by somebody in the city, begins walking there, sees an assault occurring between one of the folks on his ship, and unclear who the woman is, but like it's an unpleasant encounter. She sort of scampers off, but like he turns around, he's like, "Yeah, I don't think I'm going to do this," and he gets recognized, like he was leaving down a hallway at a conference, and you see someone you don't actually want to say hello to. And there a lot of this episode is, I think, characters reaching their final form, right? Like it is, who are you as this confrontation nears its climax, as this story reaches its end. And for Blackthorn, I think it is realizing maybe he doesn't want to go back. Like maybe this is where he wants to be. Whether he can actually fit in, you know, I don't know. The one thing I've never quite been able to get over with this show is they sort of just skip over him learning how to speak Japanese.
Right.
Like really fluently. Like they still occasionally put in a sequence.
I would not say he's very fluently. It sounds like he knows a few words.
The character we meet at the beginning of this show.
Right.
And his ability to speak the language. Yes, I'm not describing him as like fluent, but I think on the arc of not speaking and speaking, he's more fluent than not speaking. And like, I just feel like the show, I don't buy that he's sitting around like practicing the language in the way this show displays his ability to speak very coherently with a lot of people. It's not a huge hang up. It's just every once in a while, I'm like, I don't really buy this part of the character fully. And I think that is mostly just a show has less time to spend in this world than a book does. And I just have to accept that through sheer immersion, he would be able to pick up on it enough. It's just like one
maybe
point.
Maybe Mariko gave him some lessons. You know, we see them speaking in the backgrounds of many scenes. And so, like, it's possible she's like, okay, an ally means this in Japanese, or this means ally in Japanese.
Yes.
You know, like,
yes.
But I would not say he's fluent. I would say he knows, he has an okay vocabulary and can say some sentences. That's what I would describe him as. So it was enough for me, but I understand. We don't see really any of that learning going on in the show itself. So
where is my 5-minute montage set to some sad music of him working on his
You're
verbs and adverbs?
Nothing ever gonna keep me down. And then you see him, like, you know, doing calligraphy and all this stuff. Blackthorn realizes he can't go back, so he goes begging to Yabushige. Yabushige is to go alone to Osaka and give the regents the guns and cannons, but Blackthorn doesn't actually believe he's going to do this. Mariko is upset at Blackthorn's betrayal of Toranaga, but we realize Blackthorn ultimately is a man without a people. Mariko says, quote, he believes he has no choice but to make his own fate, end quote. I just wanted to call out, I thought this whole scene was very effective with Mariko translating for Blackthorn in front of Yabushige, and this idea of, like, hey, like, Blackthorn is in this place, it is a very bad place now where he feels like he doesn't belong anywhere, right? That's a very scary, upsetting place to be, and I think the show does a good job of putting him there. Oh, one other thing I wanted to call out, by the way. Blackthorn has this conversation with one of his men, and things are going not great, but acceptable, and it's only when the person insults his clothes that Blackthorn really freaks out on him. And I think it's a sign of how much he has internalized his new identity. And, like, these clothes are now a part of him, and he has pride in these clothes. And so I thought that was a nice touch, that was the thing that tripped him off. It wasn't like, you can make fun of his sailing abilities, you can make fun of his competence, but insult his clothes, that is too far.
The priest sets that up in the scene before. Closes, the priest points out, are you really going to go see them in those clothes? And I sort of expected that was a setup for him to change into something else before he went and had that conversation.
He's like, why? He's basically like, why would I change my clothes?
No, these are pretty sick, actually.
They're gonna love these stitches. Anyway, any other thoughts on the Blackthorn storyline this episode, Patrick Lepik?
No, I love this pairing, though. Like, the way the show is lining up different characters into almost, like, different parties from an RPG. Like, yes, I like the three of these together. And I want to see how they bounce off each other.
Right. Before we bring this episode home, talk about the other major plot line, you want to tell people, Patrick Lepik, where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can hear me talking about video games over at remapradio.com, and I run a parenting and gaming newsletter over at crossplay.news.
All right. And, of course, I want to give a shout-out to decodingtv.com. Become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access episodes, and bonus episodes. And we really appreciate everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible. Like, 80 to 90% of our revenue comes from paid members at Decoding TV. It's only because of the paid members at decodingtv.com that we can continue to maintain this podcast. So thanks to everyone there who keeps Decoding TV going. You can always email us. Let us know what you think of the podcast at decodingtv@gmail.com. And check out all of our videos. We're posting them on Instagram, on YouTube, and also on TikTok each week at Decoding TV. Let's talk about the main plot of the episode, Toranaga. It's Nagakata's funeral. Lord Toranaga has fallen sick and isn't showing up. At the funeral, Yabushige is discussing the situation with Hiramatsu. It turns out a lot of Toranaga's generals are still wearing their armor, which is a form of silent protest. They want to fight. Mariko meets Toranaga's granddaughter via Lady Rin and is shocked to find that Toranaga has not even met his own granddaughter yet. Another sign that Toranaga is not doing well at all. After discussing some of his options with Priest Alvito, Toranaga explains his intentions. He doesn't want to fight to the death because he thinks there will be too much bloodshed. He wants his vassals to sign a pledge saying that they will surrender with him. So the next morning, Toranaga requests everyone's signature. Yabushige signs, Omi signs with some hesitation, but then Toranaga's generals start rebelling. Hiramatsu then provides an ultimatum. Change your mind, Toranaga. Change your mind, don't surrender, fight instead, or I will commit seppuku. Toranaga does not change his mind. So Hiramatsu says, well, all right, I'm going to commit seppuku. And he asks Buntaro, his son, Mariko's husband, to second him. Which, as we all learned a week or two ago, means the person that delivers the killing blow to cut off the person's head who's committing seppuku. Buntaro initially says he wants to die too, but Hiramatsu says, no, you got to live. Also, you have to know what it means to be denied. I didn't fully understand what that, you know, like I get the concept, but I didn't fully understand exactly.
My interpretation of that was a reflection of his relationship with Mariko.
That was my initial reaction, was like, maybe he's referring to that, but we don't hear Hiramatsu talk about that too much. So I didn't know if
that's true. Exactly. That's true. That's true.
But that was my first thing, was like, you must experience what she experienced, basically, you know, like to some degree.
Right.
But maybe you have a different interpretation. And if you do, let us know at decodingtv@gmail.com. Okay. So then, Hiramatsu commits seppuku. This scene was wild, Patrick Klepek. It was so intense and upsetting, and Hiramatsu lays bare his whole friendship with Toranaga, and it's like, we've been friends since I was a kid. I believe this so much, I'm willing to kill myself. And Toranaga's just like, sorry, bud. You gots to go. Cough, cough. You gots to go. Patrick Klepek, what was your reaction to watching this?
Yeah, the whole time you're just waiting for.
Yes.
Okay.
Drop the ruse. Drop the ruse, Toranaga. Right. Like
something has got.
Surely
to give
your friend's life is more important than any ruse that could be happening right now.
And so much of the last couple episodes have been around this question of what is, if anything, Toranaga up to, and this scene is the culmination of stressing not just the characters that orbit Toranaga, but the audience's patience for this character, their approach, what may or may not be hiding behind their actions. And it's the classic sort of setup where you're expecting at the last second, I don't know, some soldier to walk in and be like, and there's soldiers at the gates. And like, everyone's got to scatter and get up, and the big action that's been threatened doesn't occur. And it does. And I think the acting on display here is tremendous. You know, like watching Toranaga's try to hold it together, like is positing forward this brave, depressed face, but you can, you know, a lot is expressed in that face, in that scene, as you're watching it, in which there's obviously complex emotions happening as is his only friend, right? Like in this show, there's lots of people that respect Toranaga, that are around Toranaga. We really are only shown one person who I think you can classify as a close friend, at least. And it is him. And so to watch all that occur, you know, you get to the end and you're like, fuck, man. Like, okay. I don't know what the next stage of this show, like, I don't know. Every situation that I've been put in where I think, all right, Toranaga's going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. I guess there's no hat and there's certainly no rabbit. Okay. Well, this is still interesting, but it's a lot more depressing than I was expecting this show to be at this point, as remarkable as it is.
I think that's one of the great things about the show is now look, Patrick Klepek, you and I have watched enough TV and watched enough movies and played enough video games to know that at any given point, we're going to find out it was all part of a ploy. Like mm-hmm, that's always possible for literally any show, right? Like, and so I think we all have that in the back of our mind. But what's great about this scene is it is so convincing that it convinces us, the viewer. Like, we are the regent surrogate in this scene. Like, because mm-hmm. the purpose of Toranaga doing this is to convince people, oh, this guy is definitely 100% no doubt going to surrender. Right? There is zero doubt this guy is toast. He is going to surrender. That's it. It's a wrap for Toranaga, right? That is the purpose of this scene. And you and I watching, I think we got, I'm not going to say 100% there, but I was 99.9% of the way there. I was like, okay, well, that's it. That's it for, like, there is no doubt. Whatever doubts there were in my head before that this was all some ploy, there is pretty much no doubt now.
And then, like, all right, this could be an interesting character study of myth, and not everything has to have a. That can be a satisfying show. It just doesn't feel like the show I was watching for a while. But that's fine. I'd love to be surprised. Thank you for surprising me, show.
Right. But you know, leaving open the possibility that it could change. But I think it was like the scene and the episode puts you in the perspective.
Yeah.
Of Toranaga's men, of the regents who are like looking at this and being like, oh, there's only one outcome for this, and that's Toranaga surrendering. And it's cool that it kind of puts you in that position as an audience. So anyway, later on, we discover Toranaga and Maruko meeting, and it was all a ploy, you see. It was a ruse, Patrick Lepik. Hiromatsu had to die to convince everyone that Toranaga was really going to surrender. So a lot of information to find out for Maruko in about a 1 minute time period. I really like her quote where he's like, hey, what's your opinion on what happened? You know? And she says, we've all suffered a deep loss today. I will not deepen our suffering by like sharing my opinion on this.
Yeah. It was like asshole, basically. Yeah.
Which is the most passive aggressive way of saying you fucked up. You fucked up.
Yeah, I suppose this was the only way to get to this point. Dipshit.
Just start adding dipshit next to all of Mariko's translations. Yeah. And it actually makes the show make a lot more sense, in my opinion. So anyway, Maruko, Toranaga asks Maruko, are you ready to fulfill your mission? And she says, I am ready. Ooh, I have a feeling it's going to involve infiltrating Osaka and killing a bunch of dudes, Patrick Lepik. We'll see. Yabushige is so disgusted by Toranaga's actions, he teams up with Blackthorn. Omi declines. He says, goodbye, uncle. You're on your own on this one. And Maruko shows up to accompany Yabushige and Blackthorn to Osaka. And then in one final scene, Toranaga thanks his son and Hiromatsu for giving Toranaga a little bit of extra time. That was very powerful as well, I thought. Any thoughts on these scenes? There's a couple of other scenes we got to cover, but yeah, any thoughts on the ending of the episode? Like, when you found out it was all a ploy, like, how shocked were you? You know, what was your reaction?
Not shocked. I guess what was fascinating is really just echoing our thoughts on the previous scene, which is, they really dragged it out. Like they just put you as a viewer, and honestly, all these characters through the mud to get to this point. Like we, how many times have you and I watched stories that are built around this very same setup and conceit? And it's like, aha, the person at the head of this, like they're up to something.
Literally,
and it's revealed.
Literally every single heist film ever made.
Sure. Yes.
Has
yes.
That moment. It's a genre of like, it was all part of the plan to have everyone die. You know, like that's every heist film ever made. Yeah.
And what I like about this is how long it takes to get to the moment where there's a sense of a plan. But also there's so much suffering to get to that point. It is not as though often when in your example of a heist, it's like, oh, like here's like, let's look back on all the scenes we just looked at from a slightly different perspective and how it all fits together. And that's not really what's happened here. Like Toranaga has killed his best friend. Like he has done despicable acts in order to make do this next desperate act that has no guarantee of success. It may just amount to a bunch of people dying fruitlessly in pursuit of, like, there's nothing about this, like the show, its final like scenes with Maruko and Toranaga, certainly like, you know, the close-ups is like, all right, like they've got a plan. But when you step away from it a little bit, I feel more in Mariko's shoes in her original response. It was like, this is the plan. Like, this is how we got here. And I'll be curious to see how that plays out through the rest of the show. Cause I don't, the way this story has played out so far, I don't expect like the next two episodes to be triumphant necessarily. Like, it's a plan, but I really don't think it's going to be, and they marched into Osaka and all of their enemies died. And then Japan was saved. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think that's the kind of story being told here. And it makes me very curious to see what are the consequences of Toranaga's approach to arriving at this plan, because it wasn't clean getting here, and I suspect it will not be clean on the other side either.
Probably going to be a Pyrrhic victory, best case scenario, Patrick Kopic.
Yes, 100%.
It's my guess, yeah. So, anyway, let's talk about a few other scenes that happened in this episode. So there was a scene with Mariko and Buntaro. You know, Buntaro asks to make her tea. He uses cha, refers to it as cha. Cha is matcha green tea. And he serves her tea, and it's a wonderful performance. And Buntaro reminisces about their first days together. They were happy, but Mariko struggles to remember. And Buntaro proposes they die together to protest Toranaga's orders. And you might think to yourself, Mariko would jump at the chance because she's been wanting to die for quite some time. But then she says, quote, "Even now you fail to understand what you've denied me wasn't death. It was a life beyond your reach. I would sooner live 1,000 years than die with you like this," end quote. Cold-blooded, Patrick Klepek. What did you think?
Well, it at least confirmed my theory from before when Buntaro asked Toranaga for a chance to kill Blackthorn. And he was told, well, then you got to kill your wife, too. That's what you're proposing here. And he was unable to do that. And my reading on that was, for as bad as a husband, as a partner, as a person as he has been, like, we've seen that manifestly in the show. He is an awful, awful person and has treated Mariko very, very poorly. He still loved her and wanted her to love him. He's done nothing to earn that from her. Even after their pairing was a matter of circumstance as opposed to choice. And so to the arrogance of Buntaro to arrive at this moment and make those sort of presumptions about how their lives should end. I mean, I'm not shocked given everything we've seen about Buntaro to this point, but I think that's why Mariko acts as sharply as she does in response, because she is only able to take the performance so far until he stretches it to the point of what life have you been living? What world of our relationship have you been telling yourself? Because it doesn't exist. And she cuts them down. Part of them, sure, is, you know, informed by the fact that she thinks they're all about to die, so might as well be honest with each other. But
it turns out, Patrick, and this is a lesson I've had to learn, putting on a nice performance and serving someone tea doesn't make up for being a dick to them for years. Like, that's just kind of really, really sad that's what it's come to on the show, you know. But if I had to learn the lesson, so does Buntaro. That's what I have to say about it.
No,
so.
That's fair. That's fair.
A couple of other scenes, the priest and the courtesans. We see Toranaga meets with the priest and he's unhappy with him because he didn't really fulfill his end of the bargain. He tried, but he's unable to get two of the other regents to ally with him. But Toranaga still gives him his church. The priest, though, is unhappy to discover that the courtesans will be his neighbors.
That was great. So. What a good
yes.
Kick in the balls at the end there.
Oh my gosh, the best land possible in Edo. You know, it's like that scene from The Simpsons of, that's good, that's bad, you know. You get a church in Edo, that's good. It's right next to all these courtesans. That's bad. Anyway, yeah, so we'll see how that plays out. There was a nice quote from that scene where Omi's hanging out with Lady Kiku, and he says, "I don't know what I'm fighting for anymore." And she says, "If you look and see nothing, you must simply look harder," end quote. And I thought that was very, very interesting. It's about basically, I think it's about the ways that we make meaning for ourselves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I read this book a long time ago by Errol Morris, not too long ago, like within the last 10 years, called Believing is Seeing. You know, and this idea of we have in our mind this idea of, like, seeing is believing. Like, once you see it, you then believe it to be true. But the book kind of put forward the idea of, like, what if it's actually your beliefs that are driving what you see? You know, what if it's your beliefs that drive how you interpret the world? And he provides some very convincing examples of that. So anyway, I thought that was a very powerful idea of, like, hey, if you don't see meaning, like, you gotta keep looking until you see meaning, you know? And that's, I think, what a lot of people on the show do to their benefit and or detriment. Any other thoughts on these scenes or this episode of the show, Patrick Klepek?
Upon further reflection on the scene where Buntaro asked to take his life and his father rejects the opportunity, I think we're right that you can read it as the reflection on his relationship with Marco, but given, as you pointed out, the lack of any sort of discussion on that, when I've thought about it further as we've gone through this podcast, the more I think about it, it's like, look at what it's his father saying, look at what's happening right here. These are two people at the end of their life having a profound disagreement. Me choosing to take my life because of this disagreement is the greatest honor I can show this relationship. You do not have, like, to be denied is like, you need to earn the right to have something that means that much, that you can commit this act to have it mean something. And so I think you can then take that and transplant that to the T scene. And in some ways, Mariko is denying him.
Well, he has denied her request to take her own life many times, right?
Right. But I think that just broadly speaking, he is saying, like, even, like, I think you can't apply it to the Mariko relationship, but I think just broadly, he's like, you need to live a life long enough, full enough, that you can actually have something that would justify an act like this, and you have not reached it, and that's why you're being denied. And that's kind of how I, after talking through this stuff here, that's kind of how I end up sitting with that scene.
That's a cool interpretation, Patrick Klepek. I'm also just going to throw this out there. On a practical level, he wants Buntaro to live to help Torunaga.
Yeah, sure.
He's like, hey, you got to stick around, because the reason I'm killing myself is so Torunaga can accomplish this mission. So, final question, Patrick Klepek. Torunaga actually sick? ?
No,
faking
not,
it?
Not a chance. I think he's sad. You know, his son was a goofball. But I think he is. I think this is all part of an act. He wants, if there are spies, if there are any observers, to send word back that Torunaga is a sad, pathetic man, and he's about to roll over, and those around him are ready to revolt.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us this week's episode of Decoding TV. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, Shogun Episode 9 and Fallout Episodes 1 through 3, plus a bonus episode about a three-body problem coming up right for you on the Decoding TV feed. Thank you so much for listening. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. We'll see you next week.